Today, we're welcoming John Arrow. This guy started Mutual Mobile, Freedom GPT, Age of AI, and he started at least 15 businesses I personally know about and a bunch I don't. And every time I talk to him, there's something new. Some unusual things about John I've known over the years. In college, he had a plane. That was kind of weird for a college student. He also had a boat. Oh, and a sailboat. He had several businesses, one making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year as a college student. He loved doing adventures like dropping a bag of flour from his plane onto his boat to see if he could hit it. He got sued by Facebook in college and wasn't allowed to join Facebook for years. We bonded over that because I got sued too. He bit-banged and hacked the Apple Watch in the beginning when it first came out to sell a charging band. He got stiffed for thousands of dollars by Yahoo, so he personally sued their CTO and resolved it quickly and made a business out of that. He started Mutual Mobile when the iPhone App Store came out and turned it into a 400-person company that sold to a public company, started Age of AI Capital to invest in upcoming companies that can have a huge impact on the world. So let's welcome John Arrow. That's quite an intro. And I feel
like that's a great intro.
So you did recently did a podcast with Hampton, right?
Yes. That was so much fun.
And so they were reaching out and they were like, hey, you've known John for years, but we can't find much about him online because you haven't been like that public online. And I was like, I have so many stories about John, and I just left a 7-minute voice note, just like rapid firing stories. And I think they just played that on the podcast for you to like respond to.
It was such a great voice note too. Like, I mean, I felt like I was watching my life flash before my eyes because you've been part of so many of those stories too.
Yeah, since maybe you were like 20, 21, something like that.
I think so.
And
yeah.
I'm like a
like
few
half
years
our
old.
Lives.
Yeah, exactly. We originally bonded over starting businesses because at UT, it was an entrepreneurship club and all that kind of stuff, but no one really started businesses. So I had a business and you had a business. And one of our mutual friends introduced us and like, you have a business? You have a business. And we kind of bonded over that. What were you running at the time? You were running a couple businesses.
It's kind of almost serendipitous that we met each other because at the University of Texas, they were actively discouraging entrepreneurship when we were there. I remember that their rankings were based on who would get a job at Dell. Basically.
Yeah.
And so they sent out this email to the entire business school at some point saying, hey, don't go start a company. You should go work for a company.
Really?
And so they were really anti-entrepreneur. And so when I found you, I felt like we were the rebels.
Yeah. I was part of this entrepreneurship club. There were 200 students and two people that had a business, me and this other guy that had a roofing company. That was it. And the whole thing. And I've asked students that are there now, same thing. Isn't that weird?
That's bizarre.
It's like 1 out of 100 actually have a business, which I still think is strange because it's easier than ever to start a business. So what were the businesses that you had when you were in college, or at least if you could talk about it?
Well, it's funny because a lot of the businesses originated from getting banned from something early on. I was using PayPal to sell things online, and then they figured out back in high school that I was under 18. Mm-hmm. And they said, hey, can you send a copy of your driver's license? I sent a copy, and they're like, oh, yeah, you can't be on PayPal. They kicked me off, but they keep your money.
Huh.
PayPal was a very interesting company. Like they'll ban you, but they'll keep your money as long as they can. Eventually got it, but it took a really, really long time. So naturally you get banned from PayPal. What do? You create a payment service. Mm-hmm. So I created a payment service where people could fund basically and make purchases by check online, which worked really, really well. But as you can imagine, some people would use it to do checks that they didn't have permission to write. So there was so much fraud on that business. I understood why PayPal was so strict and had to shut down that business. It was just, as a 17-year-old, there was just no way that you could identify and figure out who was making payments that were authentic or not.
What was the Facebook business?
The Facebook business was, Facebook used to allow you to put HTML in profiles, which I don't know why they allowed this. Maybe they thought they could be like a MySpace.
Yeah, MySpace was used doing that all the time.
Yeah, MySpace was doing it. It made it more exciting. You could put music in and images. And this was early days of Facebook, so not many people used it. But I said, well, if you could put Facebook in, you could track to see who was looking at your Facebook profile and how many times. So we made a little widget where you could put that, copy and paste that in. And lo and behold, people really liked it. If you had a crush, you wanted to see, oh, is he or she looking at my profile? Went completely viral. Facebook patched that, but then we found another exploit. And at that time, it had gone viral enough that we were able to kind of, people were using it for other things then. And they said, look, we're going to cancel your Facebook account. We're not going to get back to you unless you take down the website. It was called unfaced.com. We said, nope, we're going to keep it up. And so for many, many years, I didn't have a Facebook account.
Yeah, I remember that. You weren't allowed to get on because it was more, you had to have like a UT address and like yours was banned.
Right, exactly. It wasn't until years later that I happened to meet one of the Facebook execs that like says, okay, let me make a call and got me my account back.
So around the same time you got in trouble with Facebook, I got in trouble for a site called facebookprofile.com. And the thing I noticed was this is before you put pictures on your profile, on the profile page.
Yeah.
So when it was someone's birthday, I wanted to include a picture, but I couldn't. So I used ASCII art. You know, it's like dots and stuff like that, is like out of text to make like a balloon or something like that. And I would do that and people would be like, how did you do that? And so I made a site called facebookprofile.com that looked just like Facebook. I paid a developer to make it look like Facebook. And that started just gaining tons of traffic. And all these people thought I was Facebook because it's facebookprofile.com. And they would like, they would send us emails like, hey, I don't know how to log in, all that kind of stuff. And then Facebook sent a cease and desist, yada, yada, yada. I had that handled, but for a while I got in a little trouble with them too.
The site, yeah, I remember the site. It went super big.
Yeah. It was a fan site. I liked Facebook. I wasn't trying to like trick anyone, but I think because it looked exactly like Facebook, like in retrospect, I'm like, yeah, that's probably why they did it. But I was a stupid college kid. I thought I was being flattering by copying.
Well, it's funny that Facebook was against something like that because they're so into the hacker mindset and culture of trying things. And now that I think about it, between you and I don't know if there's any online service where we haven't either gotten banned from it outright or gotten a cease and desist. I'm serious. Facebook, Google, Twitter,
Burning
X. yeah, Burning Man. Neither of us can go back there. Like, seriously, that says something. I cannot think of an online service at some point that I or my companies have not been banned by.
But you've been good about, you always think in different ways. Like, that's, I think, why a lot of us like you. You're just like, everyone thinks this way and you think in a weird way. I remember one story, I think it was Yahoo, that like screwed you out of a couple $1,000 from ads or something. And you like personally sued the CTO and he reached out right away and solved it?
Well, this was early days of the web. And I, again, kind of 16, 17 year old version of John, I was running this company that was doing really, really well. And I had to get into my email. And because of all the customers we had, we had hundreds of thousands of email. Gmail didn't exist. And they had never contemplated kind of a business account on Yahoo getting so many emails. So I was not able to access that inbox. I tried the normal levels of escalation. And I just wanted to get in my inbox. That's all I wanted to do because it basically put the business on brakes when we couldn't get in there. And so eventually, the only way to get the attention of the person to solve it was to do a lawsuit and serve it to their CTO. And you know what? They fixed it.
Yeah. That actually opened my eyes to like, okay, how do you hack an organization? Mm-hmm. So if you want this mid-level manager to buy something from you, the way to do it is not convince them to buy it. It's convince their boss.
Right.
And then they figure it out real quick. So it's funny because out of this, I think a business idea, what was the company where you like the suing for $97?
Oh, Recourse.
Recourse. And that actually helped me, by the way. Until this day, it still helps me. Do you know this?
This is an amazing story. I didn't know it still helps you though.
Well, because I got all these points. So basically I had this problem. You started this company, I think it's like $99 a month is like suing as a SAT, as a service, where you could do a lawsuit for $99 a month, right? Was that?
That was the premise. It was like, okay, there's so many people who aren't able to access attorneys because they're expensive. I had just sold the company and I realized I had access to great attorneys, but your typical person, they're not going to hire an attorney. That seems kind of unfair that there's this class of people that can use lawyers, these class of people that can't. We said, well, what if we allowed anybody to just do a small claims lawsuit in 5 minutes? That was the premise.
And like, was that ever profitable or?
It was actually really profitable. It was interesting because people would use it for very kind of every single reason. Like we didn't police it. This was before AI, but we would just literally have some interns that would go to whatever the proper district was, submit it either in person or by FedEx or whatever. And it did really, really well. I think one of the challenges of a business like that is if you're kind of marketing to litigious people, they're likely to do credit card chargebacks. And so a lot of the people would pay with credit card and then they would win their suit and then they would charge it back, which made it difficult.
Dang.
And then the other thing about it is what we were doing, you know, I think there were a lot of people that they shouldn't have been doing those lawsuits. Again, I think you should use litigation as last resort most of the time. These people are doing them for pretty innocuous reasons where they should just pick up a phone and just call the manager to try to figure it out.
I remember I didn't really get it, but then you said I had a problem and you were just like, hey, let me try this with Recourse. I think it was like the next day after you filed that I get a call from the head of legal at Amex, American Express, big company. And she was like, how do we resolve this? And I was like, give me my points back. They made a clerical error where my number was like one number off. Someone just made a clerical error. And apparently some lady named Judy in Ohio or something was using a million plus points that I had. And this was back in the day when that was very valuable. And I went to use points. It was all drained. I was like, what's going on? And so you filed a lawsuit that said, well, clearly you got hacked because, you know, his points are gone. And the number one thing they don't want to be looked at is like we were insecure and got hacked. So she called me. How do we make this lawsuit go away? Give my points back. And I had been fighting this for like 2.5 years. And they can never figure it out because Starwood was talking to Amex and Amex was talking to Starwood. No one could figure it out. Too big of a bureaucracy. She solved it in like a minute.
And American Express is a great company. Things fall through the cracks. I'm sure they weren't doing this intentionally. You had tried the proper levels of escalation. You went through the right channels. You're one of the smartest people I know. You were following the rules, trying to make it right. And yet they didn't do that. And
well, everyone was helpful along the way, but they had never encountered something like that. So they're just like, well, I think that's Starwood's problem. Starwood's like that. I think it's it. So like having someone really high up with a big hammer to be like, just give this guy his points. We clearly messed up. Like, just give it to him.
We'll talk about the whole, like, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? That was like a very clear example where we did that. I think we did the suit and then we used a software that let us email every single person at the company. And that was probably what got their attention even faster. Because again, this is a big problem. They should be aware of it. We went through the proper channels. It wasn't dealt with. So let's just email all, 80,000 people at American Express. And after their CTO, CEO gets enough emails, I think that's why they decided to get in touch with you.
Yeah. Also, I was in the right. This wasn't like I was in the wrong. So I wasn't trying to do anything weird.
You were doing the right thing. And it's fascinating because like back then when that happened, it was a combination of probably like automated customer support in a person. And whenever we get the automated menu, the IVRs, and you have to press the numbers, we dread it, right?
Yeah.
I think in the future, near future, we're going to prefer talking to the automated person more than the human person.
Oh.
Because the automated person is going to be way more reasonable, understand the policies, and want to help and be patient.
Yeah, already. And it probably now it has access to all the information of the company. So it could probably actually do something better than like, you know, some $10 an hour person in a different country.
For sure. And it probably won't even be you calling in. It'll be your automated agent calling in to talk to another automated agent.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So running a company. So you ran a company called Mutual Mobile. It grew to like, was it like 400, 350, 400?
The
something?
Height, I think we were at 400 people.
Nice. And that was between Austin and Hyderabad?
Austin, Hyderabad. We were in San Francisco for a while. We had an office there. We had an office in Atlanta for a while. We had an office, I believe, in like Boise for a while. We were all over.
What did the company do in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, we basically made digital products. So we took big Fortune 1000 companies who didn't know what to do with the next new thing.
Uh-huh.
Early on, it was mobile. Then it became tablet. Then it was Internet of Things. Then it was AI, and we said, let's figure out how to make solutions and products and let them bring them to market.
And I remember, I think the way you started was like, I remember when the iPhone App Store came out circa 2010, you were really excited about it. And you were like, this is going to change everything.
Yes. And you and I were having some conversations about that too. I mean, I remember like the iPhone was announced 2007 with that amazing keynote from Jobs. Uh-huh. And then, which Tim Cook just resigned. We'll see how the next leadership goes. Mm-hmm. 2008, it shipped. 2009, the App Store went live. And that's when we started. It was 2009.
Yeah. And it was the first, I guess, for context back in the day, there was no way to like accept a dollar payment.
Yes.
And the App Store allowed you to do 99 cents at the click of your phone. And that was the first time you could do that.
Well, crazy story. I just remember you were the very first customer of Mutual Mobile. Did you know that? Do you remember the story?
First app?
You were the very first dollar of revenue that Mutual Mobile ever made.
You and Mickey were like, we'll pay you back. I was like, you can keep the dollar.
We didn't, I mean, again, we were like sophomores in college. We're like, no, we didn't want to go out and spend our own money to buy an iPhone. Like, well, I think we were going to get one, but we didn't have one yet. You were the first person I knew with an iPhone. And you're pretty much the first person I know with any new technology.
Yeah.
You had the iPhone. And we're like, Neville, can you download this app we made? It was called Finger Tangle. It was basically Twister for your fingers. 99 cents. And we like had never seen an iPhone in our life. We're like, our fingers crossed. We hope this thing works. Fingers crossed, literally. And you bought it and it was like, whoa. And you helped us make a dollar.
But I mean, it was funny because I've known you and your co-founder since y'all were like young and not doing anything. And then you pretty quickly like had an office and then several offices and you were buying like this whole block of offices. How come Mutual Mobile grew so much? Because there was a lot of independent developers out there. They just kind of stayed small or just like, you know, maybe five people. But then you just grew so big. Like, what was the difference? I've always been curious about that.
That's such a great question. I think from day one, we wanted to be this all-consuming thing. We wanted this to be our opus and figure out how to make enough money by running a company so that we never had to work again. That was what we were all really aligned on. That was the goal from early on. And from a marketing standpoint, we had a lot of conviction. We probably had more conviction than we should have had. Mm-hmm. So one of the early things that we did is we realized everybody in every company was searching for iPhone app development. That's what they were Googling. And we were fortunate that early on we sold a contract and we realized how much these things were worth. So we said, you know what? This is a supply constrained market. We're going to hire as many iOS engineers as we can. Then we're going to buy up the AdWords, the Google AdWords, for every single person searching for iPhone app development in related words. We realized that you could get these words pretty cheap. So much so that we decided to buy up all of the units. For the first, I'd say 3.5 to 4 years after the iPhone app development after the iPhone launched, every single ad on Google, when you search for iPhoneAppDevelopment.com or iPhone App Development, we own the URL to iPhoneAppDevelopment.com too.
I remember that. That was very impressive.
But every single ad brought you either to Mutual Mobile or it brought you to a Mutual Mobile property. And we did it in a legit way. So we created other entities because, you know, technically Google, you're not supposed to have multiple ads running for one business, but they were all our business for a really long time. So we were bidding against ourselves to ensure that we had all of the slots. And Google, at first, didn't like it, but then we started spending enough money that they became very aware that we were doing it. It's like they would send down teams of people to our, I mean, we were spending, I think, like $400,000 a month on ads sometimes.
Yeah.
And they would just come to our office, figure out how we can spend more. They became aware of what we were doing and didn't enforce it. And that's one of the things that's interesting about Google. There's really two sets of rules at Google, is what we've come to realize. You know, if you're spending enough money with them, they'll make exceptions, which I don't think is right, but that's just how they've seemed to operate as a company.
Well, you were operating in a very contentious business model, the agency business model. I know a lot of people that hate it, but it's also a great way to like be profitable from day one or not profitable for years. Was Mutual Mobile profitable right away, or was it like a long slog until you sold the company? Like, how did that work?
So from early on, we learned about the agency model. We said, let's try to get away from that as much as possible. We don't want to trade our time for dollars if we can avoid it. We want to figure out these kind of non-linear engagements where if we're able to introduce a new piece of technology or product into a company and it generates them a bunch more revenue, let's try to get a percentage of that. Now, our pricing didn't always manifest that way, but that was our goal from really early on. And so back to your question of profitability, we invested all of the profit from the company basically back into that growth engine. So we were running it as close to kind of break even as possible, which meant that our revenue went like this, but profit didn't really climb until the later years.
Was that on purpose, or is that just the nature of the agency business?
I think part of it was on purpose. Part of it was probably this vanity standpoint. We're like, okay, we want to get as big and as fat and grow as fast as we can. We thought that was the vision. Early being an entrepreneur in your early 20s, right? You kind of think revenue is the end all, right? And then we realized that, you know, revenue is vanity, profit is sanity. But it took us a while before we got to that lesson. And then when we should have learned that lesson, we started getting these unsolicited offers to buy the company. Mm-hmm. And they were all valuing the company based on revenue at the time and not profitability. We're like, okay, you know, screw profitability. We'll keep doing the revenue thing for a little while longer.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of big stories are like that, or even now you're seeing with AI stuff, a lot of these places make no profit, but they're just like growth and revenue is what people are looking at. And they base the multiples based on that. So you weren't entirely off base.
We were very fortunate with the timing. I think it was in an early market when there's a bunch of fragmentation, a bunch of growth, and you're planning to sell it, you can focus on revenue. I wouldn't go into the red, though. I think a lot of companies, especially in the services or agency space, justify going into the red and losing money. Those types of companies should not be losing money. I think they should always be in the black while they're growing.
And then over time, like, so in the beginning, you were like running the cutting edge of like iOS apps, but then it comes to the point where like any, you know, kid in Pakistan with access to Xcode on a laptop can build an app, you know, roughly as well as you can. Did that make it harder to sell? And so you had to like find new things to sell people. So then like get into tablet apps, get into VR demos, like all that kind of stuff.
We had this moment as a company when we were working with like 600 different entities at one time. And a lot of them were not like big businesses. They were small businesses, maybe venture backed, maybe not. And we're like, okay, yeah, to your point, anybody in Pakistan can do this with Xcode. So we fired nearly all of our customers in 2012, almost every single customer, we helped them find a new development partner. And then we actually started a budget practice. We called it Touch Technologies for a while. And we would send all of our small projects to there because we realized the only way to differentiate ourselves while this is commoditizing is to go upstream. And so we started working exclusively with Fortune 1000. And if you're doing work for Fortune 1000 company, there's a lot more than just the technology. You got to figure out how to integrate it into their system. You got to figure out the software maintenance style of it, the business logic behind it. And so that was a real barrier that we were able to put in place that let us keep growing.
Would you ever start an agency again, or do you not like the model?
That's a great, great question. So I think the agency, and I, you know, from my standpoint, we were running a solutions company, which I think is a little different because we were delivering a business result or a digital product more than just like consulting. Every single company that is in the consulting realm right now, from Accenture to Deloitte to McKinsey, their days are numbered. They are going down, unfortunately. If I was running Mutual Mobile right now and I had 400 people, I don't know what we would be doing with them because so many of their efforts can be duplicated in minutes now with what you can do with AI. So I'm playing with this new idea right now of how do you build, and this is with my partner Tarun, and I've been talking about this, my co-founder from Mutual Mobile, how do you build the Accenture of AI, where you literally have no employees, it's only bots, it's only AIs that are doing all of this work that traditional companies like Accenture would do. So we're experimenting right now with that. We're eating our own dog food, where we're forcing some of the businesses that we're running both together and individually are having to use this AI only consultancy. So we'll see what we'll see where that goes, but we would like to launch that maybe later this year.
Yeah, I was trying to, it's so murky, it's so foggy to see beyond like a year now, because the development is so fast that you're still surprised by what happens in 6 months. It's almost like impossible to tell. But I'm like, either agencies go away, because an agency is just like, I don't know how to do something, so I'm going to ask you how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I have expertise. But now the LLM will absorb all the expertise and just do it for you. So either every agency will go away, or every agency will thin the ranks, keep like 10 super crack developers on board. You get rid of almost all the creative people. It's just like developers that maybe have some sort of taste and can direct the AI to make things and deliver it. So I'm not really sure, where do you think the future of agencies will go? Like what's your hunch, or is it going to like bifurcate into two ways, or what will happen?
At the very highest level, it's probably going to go the way of bespoke suit makers. Most people don't get a custom-made suit, right? They go into a suit supplier, they buy something off the rack and get it tailored, and that's good enough. And that's where 99% of the suit spend is. Mm-hmm. But there still is that 1% of the top suit makers in the world where they go to London and they get a suit from scratch. That will always exist in the agency world. There will always be kind of the best people. Hmm. And I think that will become a bigger barrier for them, because they'll be the only individuals to make it. For everyone else, though, I don't know how these agencies defend themselves. I mean, already the agencies are using the AI, and it's easier to work and just tell the AI what you want to do rather than some random, college intern at an agency. So I don't know how they stay in business.
Yeah, I mean, I have two businesses.
Yeah.
One is deeply impacted by AI in a negative way.
Yeah.
One has been deeply impacted in a positive way.
Cool.
So copywriting course will ultimately get killed. The reason people came to copywriting course is a big community of about 1,000 people. And we have writers in there that you submit your copy and we help rewrite it. Well, now there's AI. You say, hey, how do I make this better? And honestly, it's pretty good. It's really good and getting better. And in fact, instead of just telling you how to make it better, it'll just do it. So you're like, so one of the main things for copywriting courses is kind of, okay, tick that off the list. Then like SEO for small companies. Well, that's like a totally different game now. So tick that off. And then all these different things that we used to help people with get ticked off. And now it's just like the people that are coming for deeper strategy and stuff like that, but rarely advice on their actual copy anymore.
I think it's a matter of time before AI start coming to you, your businesses, to get better. So you think about, the biggest barrier is these proprietary data sets. Mm-hmm. Like within copywriting, if you want to do a really good job, you have to look at existing work. You have to run bivariate, multivariate tests to see what does well. You have this deep domain knowledge out there. If you created some AIs that did that, I think other AIs who don't have access to that will want to come pay money to take advantage of that.
So a lot of people have told me to do that. Here's my retort, and I'm curious to hear what you say. I don't know the answer. I'm like, this is what I'm seeing. Every new model just gets so good that you don't need all that. So I remember when prompt engineering, remember that was a term a few years ago? And I would tell people, I'm like, I don't think this is going to be a thing in like a year.
You call it.
And the reason is, as the models get bigger, better, trained, blah, 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 like it won't need you to be like, I need something in this style. It will just know. It knows based on your history. It also knows based on like what you're looking for. Or you could just say, write like Neville Medora. It ingests everything I ever wrote, said, or did. And then it says, I know how to write like him. And it's really good at emulating people, or it was not very good, and now it's getting very good. So if you want to say, like, use Neville Medora as an example of how to write, it just knows. I don't think, like, I have to put out an MD file or anything to train it. I think maybe currently at the moment I do, but I think it'll just know. What's your thought against that? That in, like, a year, it'll just figure it out. I won't have to tell it how to write really well like me.
The thing that's amazed me the most about AI since the launch of ChatGPT, and I think it was November of 2022, is how each layer of abstraction that we have to use to interact with it starts becoming irrelevant. Like early on, you had to do that prompt engineering that you were talking about. It reminded me of the early days of like object-oriented programming. You had to know how to do the objects correctly to get what you want. And then all of a sudden, a lot of software like Visual Basic came out, and you could just use a visual GUI to move things around. right now, I don't think you have to do any prompt engineering, right? You can just talk to a model, say, I want this piece of software, and it will deliver it better than 99% of engineers could do it. The next phase, I suspect, will be outcome as a service. So basically, you'll just say to this AI, I want this business outcome, go deliver it. I don't care if you need to create software to do it. I don't care if you need to hire people to do it, whatever, just go create it. Here's a test that I've been doing. I do this once a week, like clockwork across every agent, is I say, using nothing from me, no intervention from me, using nothing you know about me or anything that I have, go generate $1 of revenue.
Isn't that what Google just released like 18 hours ago?
Wait, what was this?
Oh my God. Off the top of my head, like Google Charlie. It was some random name. I forgot what it was. I never heard the name before. They just released it literally yesterday. And it's outcome-based. When you said that, I was like, wait, are you talking about that? It's an outcome-based thing. So you may have just called this exactly, and this just happened.
Well, you
so,
use every new piece of technology before anybody else. See, that's so I'm glad.
I think I'm just on social media a lot. And so you tell it what you want, and then it just figures it out. So I think the modern version that you're talking about now, like object-oriented program, you don't have to learn all that. I think the current version, this is maybe a hot take, the agent stuff. Mm-hmm. I think the agents where they're like trying to train an agent to be like, he's your CMO, he's your copywriter, he's your image guy. I'm like, I don't think you're going to need that in like a year or 6 months. I think actually currently they're phasing a lot of that stuff out with what Google's doing. It's like, you know, forget all the agents. You don't need to do all that garbage. We'll figure it out. Like, we'll just do that behind the scenes. So I think agents might go the way of that.
It seems inevitable. It seems inevitable because that's what people really care about. They care about an outcome, right? Yes. They don't care about some intermediary step to getting it. And so if you try this test now, and I haven't tried it with, is it Charlie?
It's probably not called Charlie. It's called something else, okay. But we'll edit it in. Yeah.
Something. I want to check that out because right now when I try this with any of the OpenAI agents, or I try this with Gemini, or with Open Claude, or I try this with Perplexity Computer, which is really good, by the way, right now it struggles. What it will do is it will start off in a really ambitious way, and it'll go to like paid survey websites, and it'll start to try to do the paid surveys for you.
That's not bad. Not a bad start.
Or it'll go to a Crypto Faucet website and hang out. Or it will decide, you know what, I'm going to generate something relating to how to use AIs better and try to sell it. And it will try all these things and it will fail. It will go really, really far. Sometimes it will because of a CAPTCHA, but now all of these agentic services will get past CAPTCHAs. It will fail for just kind of a bizarre reason, or it will need your intervention. And I think we're really close to the point where all of a sudden it can get past that. And once it gets past that, once you figure out how to prompt an AI agent to make a dollar once, you could spin up 10 million instances of that. And that's when money starts becoming irrelevant.
Well, what about this? Or it goes physical. Right now, the AI can't do it. I mean, you know, when we get Optimus going full production, maybe that changes. But at the moment, maybe it'll be like, all right, the human still has to move something from here to there. Which, by the way, you also made a company about that, I remember. Remember you had like a rent-a-human thing where you like FaceTime with like someone? And
that's right.
They would do something like go to the grocery store and you could like follow what they're doing.
We called it borrowed eyes. And the idea was they could go check on something. Maybe you're running a store and you want to see, did you leave the lights on, or what's the number of customers there? That's going to come back full circle.
There's already companies that will pay you to like wear a little camera and do your laundry.
Fascinating. For training.
Yeah. But do your laundry and do tasks. Grab something out of the refrigerator. I want ketchup. And then you say that, and then you grab ketchup. And then you say, I'm going to fold this laundry and put it in the right place. And then they just upload. It's just like Tesla's method of just like uploading tons of videos of driving, and the robot learns how to drive without humans.
Wow. Okay,
there's current companies like that.
I need to look into some of those. Here's a crazy thought for you. Let's say you have an Optimus robot from Tesla. Like you have it right now, Neville. What would be the biggest economic thing that it could do for you?
Take care of my baby.
That would be cool.
Yeah. Take care of my baby and clean the, like what our nanny does is very valuable.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff.
And it would never need to go home or never get tired. That'd be great.
It could, you know, honestly, like in the beginning with the baby, you're just like, you know, with this brand new baby, you're like, is the baby breathing? Like you can't see and stuff. I would love the Optimus to just sit over and just stare at it. You remember that scene in Terminator where he's guarding John Connor inside of the abandoned gas station?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And he just stands there all night, and there's a sunset rolling and everything. And he stands there with a gun protecting him constantly. And the minute something happened, he would take over. That's what it is.
I never even thought about that. You're right. Childcare. That's going to be huge. I was thinking
the biggest
like,
thing.
Yeah. That's going to be the most immediate thing probably is childcare. It's not going to be like doorman or whatever. It's or robots at, I don't know, conferences at Booth Babe equivalent, it's going to be childcare.
I mean,
probably.
It'll be all, I mean, I assume the way that it'll roll out is first, it's going to be in factories where it can't hurt anyone. Mm. You know, it's doing stuff that, like, if it messes up, it's inconsequential. But then it'll start, like, we have both witnessed the birth of the self-driving robot, you know, firsthand with, like, Tesla's just being able to drive. So you see, like, V2 of Autopilot, and it kind of sucked. V3 was, like, pretty impressive, but still had 1% of the time where it messed up. And now it's, like, perfect. So you're like, okay, this is going to be the same time frame for Optimus. It's going to happen.
It's going to be insane.
Yeah. But let me ask you this. So I don't know if you feel this, but when you were talking about, like, oh, if you're working on agents now, maybe, you know, ChatGPT 7 will just solve it and, like, you won't need it. Or this new Google product, it, like, doesn't need agents. It just knows the outcome. Do you ever get this feeling that, like, whatever you're building in AI right now or whatever a company is building, you're just like, is it just going to do this? Like, everything I'm building right now, I'm like, you know, some advanced AI down the line will probably just do this. Do you ever feel that? And how do you grapple with that thought of, like, what to build?
It's so perishable, isn't it? You make something with AI and then all of a sudden it's kind of irrelevant that you made it. I suspect the way to do it is to shift to the outcome mindset. How can I get this AI to produce something that's an outcome rather than an intermediary step? So all of these companies, like, one of the things you mentioned, Age of AI, which we founded after we sold Mutual Mobile to start investing in AI companies, we began taking a lot of pitches. And most of these companies, we realized, were going to be irrelevant in a few months. One of the main model developers was just going to incorporate that into this wrapper, and that company wasn't going to need to be there. I think the sustainable thing to do if you're building a company in AI is to just focus on selling the business result, because nobody's really marketing or differentiating that way. And once you get that, then you'll be able to compete on how much does it cost to get that business result? How quickly can you get that business result? How close is it to what I actually want? And one of the fascinating things when I've been playing with agents right now is it feels as if you have superpowers. Mm-hmm. I've been an investor in Anthropic, so I'll disclose that. Anthropic, I feel like, is not winning anymore on the agentic race. I think it's Perplexity Computer, which I don't have any interest in. I don't think I own any. Perplexity was a company that was kind of like the AOL of AI, where it wasn't that useful early on. It was people who didn't know how to use it. But they recently launched a new agent called Computer. And when I use it, I feel like I have superpowers. Hmm. An example of something that you could do that I haven't yet done, it would be very, very bad, is you could basically tell it to cause a traffic jam. And you might need to prompt it a little bit, but it could go create Uber accounts for you and call a bunch of Ubers to different locations and literally create a traffic jam. And it's, like, that good. It might take a little bit of encouragement, but it will do it eventually.
Wow.
I don't advocate doing that. I'm just saying that's how powerful it is. You can use it for good, too. You could have it literally go out and find, one of the things that we were amazed with is it can go find unclaimed money that's owed to you and go collect it for you.
So, I mean, this is really interesting, selling the outcome rather than the actual software. And I felt this because, like, I play around. I currently use Codex quite a bit. I found it to be really good. I also have a developer I work with, and he's creating stuff. And it's fun because you get really excited that you're, like, in my old brain now, like, dinosaur brain from when, like, creating a software company was, like, the ultimate, right? Yeah. For when we were growing up, if you could create a software company that sells software and gets people on ARR, MRR, that was golden. That was the best thing in the world. Now, it's so easy to create this software that, like, AppSumo, for example, which I'm involved with, is like flooded with, like, just, like, vibe coded apps, right? That are, like, kind of crappy, and you could build them yourself in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. Now, there's always going to be a market of people out there that don't want to build their own apps and just, like, you know, if you're going to solve this problem for $20 a month, I'll pay you. But the problem is now there's everyone can compete with your company. So I can build Calendly in about the next 4 minutes.
How wild is that?
I can tell Code, you know what Calendly does? Do that. Build me a thing. Make it to where it can handle 1,000 customers, and it'll do it. It'll do it on first pass. Now, it never, like, implements it perfectly the first time, but, like, imagine in 2 years, it will. So, like, it's going to get there. So now, like, Calendly, it's a big $3 billion company. It's just like, okay, well, now, like, all these other competitors are coming to eat its lunch by offering free or lower cost versions of it. And so it's almost like everything I've been building software-wise, I'm like, dude, this would have been awesome 6 years ago. And now it's not awesome. Now it's, like, not even a business. It's like a lot of that stuff is just, like, almost gone. So you have to, like, think of new ways. So for example, with Swipefile, I mentioned one business copywriting course going downhill because of AI. Swipefile's going uphill.
Nice.
Because I used to save stuff I thought was cool marketing. Now I can have AI analyze it, make different images, extract the value from it, redo it as different companies. It can do a lot more stuff that we couldn't do before. And so one of the ways we're getting new customers is just giving away free software. That used to be a very difficult thing to do. But now, instead of just like an email newsletter to get people to sign up their email, it's just like, well, you get access to all our software. And we can build the software relatively quick. And it's not good enough to charge $100 a month for, but it's good enough to get for free.
Mm.
So it's kind of like moving the free line up with what you could build. But all the stuff that we thought was awesome before is now like, let's just keep it as an internal tool or give it away for free.
That's such a smart way to do it. I had this epiphany last week. I was on a run in Manhattan. I was running down the West Side Highway. And one of my favorite things to do is to look at the super yachts that are docked along there. Mm. And I happened to look over and I see the largest super yacht I've ever seen in my entire life. It had like two helipads on it. Mm-hmm. And I was super curious. So I run over to it. I look at the back of it. I talk to the crew a little bit and they do a good job. They don't disclose who it is, but I grab the name of the boat, look it up. The guy who owns the super yacht was an early executive at Microsoft who was responsible for creating Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel.
Hmm.
And this allowed him to basically buy the most expensive yacht in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You think about what you just said, all of that work can now be done in 10 minutes. You could probably really legitimately recreate Word and Excel in 10 minutes. So the cost of creating software, the capital expenditure, is basically nothing. Now, if you want that super yacht, that's still a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're saying about giving the software for free is fascinating, as well as this long tail of problems where it was not economical to make software for because it was just too specific. Now, anybody can have software for anything because the capital costs have essentially approached zero. So giving it away for free is smart. I like that way of thinking about it.
Do you see an analogy to like the dot-com boom and then subsequently the iPhone boom of what's happening now? So the analogy I'm seeing is like, circa 1999, I was in high school and went to college in 2001. And the internet was coming up. It was the dot-com era, right? And the thing is, everyone was correct, but timing was wrong. So, for example, everyone was like, the internet's going to take over everything. It's going to take over all retail. We're going to be online. The problem is it took like 10 to 15 years. And it really took until the iPhone 3 to really become true. And that was then, that it ended up being, you know, 12, 15 years later. So everyone was correct, but they were early. And I think right now I'm seeing the same thing where some of these companies are valued insanely, yet they make no revenue, they make no nothing. So I think we're correct. Like AI is going to be everywhere all the time, faster, better. Like we all know that. But currently, when you use AI, it does have limitations. So we say you could build software, but like not anyone could just do that and deploy a live website. It still takes a developer to actually do it, modify it. And then, you know, when you make like seven modifications on a piece of software, it starts glitching a little bit, all the models. So it's like, it won't at some point, but it currently does.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing this like, we all know that it's going to be here. We're all correct, but we're not there. And so there's this weird discrepancy that I'm always worried about of like, is this an overvalued company? Because there's going to be a few companies, probably like Tesla, SpaceX, and a few more that are valued very high and probably will value 10 to 100x in the coming decades. But most of the companies are probably just overvalued. Is that a thing you're seeing?
It certainly seems that way. If you look at Intel finally, like 20 years later after the dot-com bust, its stock price exceeded what it was at the height of the bust.
Really? It took that long?
It took that long. It just happened. Right. So, I mean, people's expectations and enthusiasm always seem to get in front of results. That's certainly what's happening here. I mean, this is playing out AI. The AI wave is playing out pretty identical to any other wave, whether it was mobile, whether it was dot-coms, whether it was electricity. People get really, really excited and they overinvest in these things. There's massive fragmentation. Everybody and their grandma starts one of these companies up. And then what ends up happening after the fragmentation, there's inevitably consolidation. These things get acquired, they go out of business, and we're left with less companies because all of a sudden results and fundamentals start to matter. What I do think is somewhat different about AI versus dot-com and about mobile is the velocity of the evolution of the technology is happening much, much faster. It's getting incredibly better. If we think back to the early days of ChatGPT and other LLMs, you would get like a funny answer from it or something. It would be mildly helpful. It was somewhat of a replacement for Google, which is how most people use AI today. But you certainly weren't building software with it. Now you can imagine any software product that's ever existed and effectively have it in 10 minutes. That's crazy, because if we keep extrapolating from that recursively, we're going to be at that business outcome phase that we talked about. And I think then it's delivering real economic value, and it might not be overpriced. That being said, I don't think you're going to be able to pick, you know, any of us are going to be able to pick which company is the winner here. So I think the best way to do it, rather than investing, is to try to build things yourself and get familiar with it that way.
Yeah, that's because you mentioned with Intel finally peaked after the dot-com bubble. However, if you bought Amazon, Google, and there's a couple others, you'd actually be way ahead.
Way ahead.
It would have taken 5 years. There would have been a slump, mm-hmm. but now you would have been up 10, 40X.
Right.
But that's only like 3 out of like 1,000 companies.
Pets.com, Dr. Coop, Vignette, right? All of these. Yeah. If you invested in a bunch of them, you'd be okay. But if you just tried to pick one or two, it was a roll of the dice.
Yeah.
And most of them went to zero.
Honestly, I think the phone enabled also like going to India, and you've been to India a lot. I think one of the things of like, you know, India was a legit third world country back in the day. And now there are parts of it that are, I mean, seemingly more advanced than the US, pockets that are there. And I think it's the internet. I mean, it really was the internet that democratized access to stuff in a place like India and other parts of the world. And like, you know, we live in our country where you just had like broadband everywhere and Wi-Fi, and you just kind of take it for granted. But the phone really leapfrogged and gave everyone internet all the time, cheap and easy and free. So I wonder what the AI version of the iPhone will be. Have you ever thought about like what that will be?
What's the AI iPhone moment?
Because when the iPhone moment happened, I don't remember people being like, the iPhone's going to take over everything and make the whole world better. I don't remember people saying that back then. It's only after it happened that people were like, oh, I can see where this is going.
And it might not just be AI. It might be a confluence of a few things. Like you think about AI combined with Starlink now. So like India has amazing infrastructure from a telecom standpoint from where it is economically. Excuse me, but now everybody has internet, right? So I wonder if like you have some of these things feeding together that produce results that we might not even be able to imagine. What I'm hoping is the iPhone AI moment is people being okay with letting their entire day be listened to. And then you have this personal assistant that basically will help you make better decisions. So we'll hear life and we'll say, hey, here's how many times a day you're upset about something, you're frustrated, you're curious, you're excited. I'm going to try to help you make more of those decisions tomorrow.
Here's my hypothesis.
Let's hear.
This might sound totally stupid. Do you remember the famous job speech with the iPhone? He's like, we've made an iPod, an internet navigator, and a telephone, an iPod. And he repeated it, and everyone's like, oh, shit, it's one device. Oh, my God. It's going to be that. And what it's going to be AirPods. It's going to be your phone. And it's going to be some sort of like Alexa-style chatbot. Right. It's going to be those three things combined into glasses. And the reason I say iPhone moment is because it democratized the internet. Before, you had to have like a big ass PC and, you know, like like your hardware was always a constraint. It was always expensive. The iPhone was like a nominally expensive thing and had everything you could ever do. It wasn't as good as your PC, but it let you do everything. Mm-hmm. You could use Excel on it. Did it suck a little bit? Yeah, it was not as good as the desktop, but it let you do it. And this really showed whenever I go to India and my cousins would use their phone for 100% of everything. And I was like, you don't use a laptop? I'm like, no, you got a phone. And I'm like, yeah, but it sucks. They're like, I mean, I could do everything on it. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, you can. Like, it's a good option. So I think like, I don't think my mom uses a lot of AI on a daily basis. However, she had a pair of glasses that was looking at things, and you're like, where's the blah, blah, blah aisle in the grocery store? And it just goes, oh, it's that way. And it just overlays. I think something like that will be our iPhone moment.
It certainly seems like the computer is going to become way less relevant, the desktop, right? I mean, right now, voice is a much better input method most of the time, unless you're doing really serious
work. Yeah, with AI, voice is just like skyrocketing.
Right, right. And then iPhone's going to be releasing the foldable, or Apple's going to be releasing the foldable iPhone this year. I don't know why you'll have to go back to a computer. I find myself going back to a computer way, way less. And so it just makes sense. You're in the environment anyways. You're interacting with it. Why should you be sitting behind a desk?
I mean, I think we were all a little early. Me and you, we used to be big into VR. I remember we'd go to your office and play like the big VR sets. I had all the versions of Oculus. I kind of lost interest over time. The progress was like a little bit slow on it. But I remember, like, have you ever used like Meta workspaces and stuff?
I've used them all, and I think they're novel. But the utility that you get based on the friction of having to put them on isn't there yet. Here's where I think it gets super addictive, and this is maybe that confluence. If you combine AI with VR and you use it to let you predict, and like maybe you're wrestling with a big life decision and you're trying to say, okay, what was my life going to be like if I do A versus B? and it lets you simulate things out and you get to live both of those experiences in VR. You're like, oh, I'm definitely going to go with B now because I know that. Then it might be worth the friction of fully immersing yourself.
I remember using Workspace. It sucks. Like, it's not like a legit work. It's not like a legit thing you're going to actually use in its current state. But I was like, okay, extrapolate a few versions out. This is it. This is how we're going to be meeting. So right now it's like cartoon heads and it's garbage and, you know, it's latency and stuff like that. However, when it's better, I think that's going to be, I think this is going to be the AI iPhone moment. It's going to be a pair of glasses that does at first a little bit of stuff, not full VR or anything, but it has like a screen and AI. It's basically Meta Ray-Bans, but like a few versions down. The current Meta Ray-Bans, not impressed by, but when it has a screen and it's better, I think could be the thing.
I think you might be right. I could see that. What's the most amount of time you've ever spent in VR?
Hour?
Yeah.
And that was, you know, when you first get it, you're like looking for stuff to do.
Right.
And then eventually you get bored. Like during the pandemic, me and some friends would play ping pong virtually and stuff like that. And that was fun.
Yeah. But then you kind of, the utility isn't really there. Do you find, okay, maybe this is a related heuristic then. How many conversations, do you think you have more conversations a day with a real person or with an AI?
Oh, good question. I mean, probably AI.
I mean, it's definitely an AI. Yeah. I feel like that's going to become the norm for most people. Like, we're early on this stuff, but I feel like that's going to be the norm for most people. Eventually, it's probably going to be that stat. Do you spend more time in real life, IRL, or do you spend it in augmented reality?
Yeah, I mean, already, you could say that stat back in the day was, do you spend more time in real life or staring at a black screen?
Right.
How much, I mean, we're always looking at it. And then I think when the glasses, it's like you're going to be on a screen all the time. I think right now, like, so the parallel I draw with VR and the web was it used to be like, let's get online, like America Online. You would get online. You would log in. Now it's like, use your phone. It's just, there's no such thing as offline now. You're just always online. Similarly, I think with the screen right now, you're like looking at a screen, looking at a phone, looking at something. But when it's on your glass, you'll always be like, there'll be 100% of the time.
I think that's where it's going. And then you won't even need to prompt the AIs. It will know what you want to ask.
It'll know what you're doing.
Even before you know. That's going to be the amazing element. Like, you pull out your phone to ask a question, it's already got the answer.
Yeah. So, okay. So last couple of questions. And so we run a thing called Swipefile. Swipefile is basically a collection of marketing campaigns. Back in the day, people used to collect like ads and like put them into a physical folder. Now marketing is like spread out across all the different mediums. I like collecting it. This is why I know about a lot of stuff. I'm just on social media and reading the web all day. And it basically had to scratch an itch of like, I want to save something and do stuff with those results. And so I created Swipefile, and that's like the main thing people come for now. So I'm curious, like specific campaigns, if you can remember, and if you don't want to say certain stuff, don't tell me, but what are specific campaigns that you did that had the highest ROI, maybe specifically Mutual Mobile, but even other companies, like unique campaigns that you did, or if it's just not unique, but it was very effective, like highest ROI?
Well, the cool thing about enterprise is that the customer value sometimes is just so insane. Like, we've had clients that will spend $10 million a year with us when we were running Mutual Mobile. And so we were able to kind of get really creative on reaching these specific people and individuals at these companies. So one thing we did is we went out and bought the newest iPad, and we made a little presentation for them, and we FedExed the iPad to the decision makers at this company. Like, here's what we think mobile could do for you, or what we think tablet could do for you. And that had an insanely high ROI. Like, it was amazing to me how often, not only would we get a call, but some type of engagement related to that. There was a really hilarious one, though, where we sent it to the CEO of the time of General Dynamics, which makes like Gulf Streams and missiles and a bunch of stuff. And he like wrote back this handwritten letter to us telling us not to do this, and that he's not allowed to accept gifts. Our iPad's been donated to some like child's charity. So we didn't even send it back.
He probably thought it was bugged.
Weirdly enough, we did actually end up doing some stuff with General Dynamics, but not because of that, in spite of it.
So you would like, would you like write a note inside of it and be like, hey, thanks, why don't you open up this iPad, see what it says?
We would literally, I don't think we had the note anywhere else but on the iPad. They would just turn on the iPad and it would just start a presentation.
Wow.
Or maybe it was an Android tablet, it was a long time ago.
Huh.
We probably switched to Android tablets because they're way cheaper.
What were other ways that you would acquire business from Mutual Mobile? Because you're dealing with Fortune 1000, are they like reaching out to you, or are you reaching out to them?
You can't depend on them reaching out. I mean, you always have things that fall on your lap, and that's great. Just like when you're playing chess, right? It's always wonderful when you're playing an opponent who makes a bad move early on, but you can't depend on that. One of the things that we would do is try to be really proactive with creating videos. So we'd create a video of a product idea that we had for maybe a smart mattress. That was a real one that we did. And then we'd send it to every mattress company that you could think of Slack Comfort said, whoa, this is incredible. We want to do this. We made one of the first connected beds with them and did this giant sleep study back before 8Sleep and any of those companies were around.
Oh, so you mean like you saw this opportunity that mattress companies make a lot of money. We can connect an app to that. And this is back in the day when that was awesome. And you thought like we can go into this mattress industry. Here's the 10 mattress companies. Just reach out.
Exactly.
And that was very proactive then.
It worked super well. I mean, we didn't have a hit every time. We made a lot of these videos within industries where nobody bit, but we just needed one, right?
Huh.
We just needed one of these companies. And we would make it a bit competitive. Like, oh, we let them know. We've sent this all to all your competitors, right? We only work with one. So you got to let us know which one. Another thing that we did earlier on was with direct email. And we recognized how expensive it was to buy these lists. Mm-hmm. Like there were ways to get the executives' lists. We found Jigsaw, if you remember Jigsaw, I think it was acquired by Salesforce. They would give you the email address of any executive. Mm-hmm. It was really, really expensive. So what we would do is we would generate our own email lists and then load it up to Jigsaw. And it would tell you if you already had that email. And so we were able to pinpoint for free which email address that was.
This is why I like you, your way of thinking. It's just...
We calculated how much we saved by doing it this way, and it was like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
Yeah. These email accounts are really effective.
Interesting. Are they still as effective?
I don't think so. You need to up the salience, and you're really good at this with how you reach people now. If you use the modality matters. If you use something like direct mail or text message or email or whatever, it's hard to stand out. So the much better approach is to do something just incredibly ridiculously salient.
Huh. We have a buddy, Kunal Das, we both know really well, and he's like a big sales guy. And I was asking him, because he used to cold email a lot, or like the teams that would get him leads to close like giant deals. And I was just like, do you send cold emails? He's just like, of like all the clients I've worked with in the last year, like maybe one or two actually reached out. Whereas everyone we do outbound outreach. That's like almost 100% of all B2B business now. I think everyone's just like spammed with cold emails now that I don't know how the effectiveness is. It's probably just gone down tons.
I'm imagining so, because it's so easy to do these email campaigns. You can have an AI do it, right? A lot of people won't even read things with an M-dash anymore because they know it's written by email.
I mean, I get so many, and honestly, the emails are so good and it's customized to me. So it kind of like baits you like, whoa, is this a person? And then you have to like really like look into it to be like, is this a bot or is this a person? It's getting hard to tell.
That's a great point. Oh, you just remind me of a really great strategy that used to work with us. So this worked well if we were trying to get a customer to do additional business with them with us. We would say, look, we're trying to do a promo video for our company. Can we fly you down here first class and have you do a testimonial for us? And they would more often than not, they would love that. It was a vacation away from work for a little while. They would talk about how great we were. And then inevitably they would say, oh, we actually have this new business need. And that worked so well. There was this company called Greenway Medical out of Atlanta that we did a ton of work with for 10 years. And that's how we kind of kept doing business with them.
What do you think the ROI on something like that is?
I think it's like a 1,000 to 1.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just insane.
Probably cost you $2,000.
Yeah, most.
To fly them out, record a video, and they do $2 million a year of business.
Yeah, it was insanely high ROI. There was another idea we never tried, but we wanted to do like a big conference where we had like people come in, our customers come in and speak. Or maybe we did a small version of
this.
Kind of
like a HubSpot or Inbound or a lot of like Salesforce really or something. Yeah.
Really good there.
Yeah.
Sapphire, SAP.
Yeah, I think a lot of those, yeah. And then that person gets to look really cool that they're speaking on the stage, and also people want to come to a conference.
Right.
Yeah, what about some other cool marketing campaigns you've done for any of your other companies, defunct or not?
Ooh, yeah, okay. Let's think of it.
I mean, like Freedom GPT went super viral.
It went insanely viral.
Well, how did that happen?
So here's what happened. A bunch of people had the same thought that we did at about the same time. I want to use an AI that will let me look up anything. It will never give me an answer saying that's inappropriate, right? Like people would do this test early on with ChatGPT, where can I hide a body or something like that?
Okay.
And it wouldn't answer that question, right? And it would scold them. It reminded me of just early days of using AOL Instant Messenger and talking to Smarter Child, where it would basically say your question's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people wanted that experience, but to be able to use it any way they wanted. So we put out a piece of software, Freedom GPT, that let you do that early on. And it was the only thing at the time. So it got written up in Reddit a ton. What we found from just a AI SEO standpoint, or GEO as they call it now, Reddit is the ground truth. These models love looking at Reddit, and they trust Reddit a ton because, one, they police it. It's really hard to shill on Reddit. You need these aged accounts. And two, they let AIs do that, They're open to AIs using that content. And so we got written up by Reddit, and that is what caused these other AIs to recommend FreedomGPT. The main way we get traffic today is somebody will go to ChatGPT, they'll ask a question, ChatGPT will refuse, and it will say, well, maybe you should try FreedomGPT. The person will ask.
ChatGPT will recommend it. Do you think they know that they're doing that?
Not only do they not know, but we are in I can talk about this. We are in litigation now with ChatGPT. They are coming after us for using GPT in our name. We're FreedomGPT. They're OpenAI. They do not have the trademark to GPT.
Yeah.
The USPTO has said, no, you can't have that. It's a general enough term. They're using this bizarre technicality where they're trying to basically shut down any company that has GPT in their name.
Doesn't it just mean general
generative pre-trained transformer?
Okay.
Yeah. And so they don't have it. They were told, but there's this technicality where because they had ChatGPT-3 and they trademarked that, if nobody protests it for, I think, 3 years, they can go back and try to get this retrospective trademark. And so they shouldn't have it. They're going up against us. And they're also allowing people to create these fake GPTs called FreedomGPT, even though we own the trademark FreedomGPT. So there's definitely a bit of a love-hate relationship that we have with OpenAI. I can understand why Elon is upset with them too. Uh-huh. Their way of doing business is somewhat questionable on that front. Hopefully we can resolve it.
Oh, one of our friends just went through this for like 3 years. His company is called Impossible. I don't know if you know Joel Runyon or not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but it's like a small company called Impossible. And then Impossible Foods was like, hey, you can't use the name. He's like, I had it for like 10 years before you. And so they started harassing him and just like taking him to court. He's a small guy. He'll cave. He didn't cave. And he recently won the litigation after 3 years.
Good for him.
Yeah. And he won like several $1 million. And plus more he's going after for fees and stuff like that.
Rightly so. I mean, we had the same trademark dispute. We had this trademark dispute with Squarespace because they said our interlocking M's look too different to their interlocking S's. And it was like they were long discussions, and eventually they had enough. And eventually they paid us to change our logo. That was.
And then one last question about something like Mutual Mobile. Whenever you would get business for like a B2B place like that, do you think like in person was better?
There was no replacement for in-person. In-person was so critical. Getting on a plane, going in front of customers and being there is people will make decisions based on heuristics. And the relationship is one of the best heuristics that's out there.
Would y'all go to conferences and stuff like that?
Only when we were speaking, generally. We used to try conferences when we weren't speaking and they weren't that effective. If we had a speaker, they were wonderful, though. Yeah,
people. You meaning up. Like if you sponsor a conference and just have a booth, they're kind of like, eh.
Yeah. But if you had a speaker, people would line up afterwards saying, "Hey, my company needs help with this, this, and this." And so that was one of the best ways to get business.
Okay. Yeah, one of my friends was like, "I would rather host a dinner with 4 people than send out 10,000 cold emails."
Oh, for sure.
Because 2 of them would end up doing business with them in some way down the line. Maybe not directly, but like indirectly, like, "Hey, our company's looking for this. We can't do it. Can you do it?" So they like kick the ball over to him. Versus like sending 10,000 cold emails, like results in almost nothing now.
Exactly. I mean, I get all of these pieces of outreach that fall to me even to this day. People want to know how to build pieces of software now, and I'm not allowed to touch consulting for a little while longer because of our transaction. Uh-huh. But as soon as we're done with that, I'm really excited to let AI help them.
Nice. And then last question is about Age of AI. So this is like your investment firm. Have you? On the website, it says you've only done like 4 or 5 investments. Mm-hmm. Is that true? So it's like Anthropic.
We were in Anthropic.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a big one.
That was a big one.
Yeah.
That was a great one.
When did you invest in that?
We were in the Series B for that.
Now in Series G or something now.
Right. Which, I mean, Series B probably sounds more impressive than it was as early, but now the companies are doing crazy valuations at Series A, right? I heard about like a $3 billion Series A the other day.
Yeah.
And so we were in early. It was a really, really good outcome. But you always wish you were in earlier. I've been super underwhelmed with a ton of the pitches that I hear for early stage AI, as I was mentioning. So originally, when we started Age of AI, we were going to do investments in early stage AI. We just didn't really find anything investable. That's why we ended up with like Anthropic and kind of not much else.
Interesting. You're also in Gel Blaster?
Yeah, so Gel Blaster is an interesting one. Tarun's the one who manages all of that. This is this like toy gun that shoots gelets.
Yeah, I know. That's why I saw it, I was like, wait, what?
And they sell like $80 million of these things a year.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
And basically, kids wanted an in-between from Nerf before they go to paintball.
Yeah.
Because paintballs really, really hurt. Nerfs aren't that much fun. This is that middle ground where it stings when it hits you, but it's not going to cause injury. You probably don't want to get shot in the eye. You should wear glasses, but I mean, it's not going to kill you if you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. And is that like a software play or just like it's a toy company?
It's a software enabled hardware product. So the way this company makes most of its revenue now is setting up as an alternative to laser tag. So you go into a place, it keeps track of where you were shot and reports it back, and you can rise and climb the leaderboard to see who's the best sharpshooter out there.
This is an interesting thing about like moats. It's like it has this physical tie into this gun, a toy gun that shoots gel, and then they put the software on top of it. It's not just like a pure software thing.
Exactly.
Huh. Interesting.
Which Apple does really well. Like Apple's the best company in the world. Tesla's probably maybe neck and neck with Apple on that of doing the software and the hardware. If you could do both together, that could be almost impossible to stop.
Yeah. And now they got new leadership. So I'm curious to see, because he was the guy who actually designed a lot of this.
Yeah, that's right. I was hoping they brought Steve Jobs back.
I miss Steve Jobs. I guess Elon's the new Steve Jobs right now.
He is. I mean, he's going to be our Albert Einstein, our Thomas Edison, you name it all in one, Ben Franklin.
What's your read on what will happen with SpaceX, Tesla in the next couple of years?
It's hard to imagine a scenario where they don't become one company, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think PayPal even. If you look at PayPal, PayPal looks cheap. They're trading at 9x earnings.
And they suck ass.
You recommended, the first time I heard of Elon Musk was because of you. Many, many years ago, before anybody knew who Elon Musk was, you said, you got to read this book called PayPal Wars.
Yeah.
That's the first time. And the book tried to paint Elon in a really negative light, but I immediately connected with him and thought what he was doing was so, so cool. And I remember he got ousted from PayPal. So it seems only fitting that he might try to buy PayPal back.
Yeah. Well, he was originally X, and then they turned it into PayPal. So he did X, and that turned out pretty well, I would say. And then, yeah, maybe he'll buy PayPal. I know he's been trying to do like a money thing for a while.
It just seems so natural. 9x earnings. They always say the most entertaining outcome is the most likely. That would be super entertaining.
What other industries are you looking at right now? Obviously, AI, we're in the AI hype phase at the moment. Like, are there any other industries that you're kind of like secretly looking at that everyone's kind of like neglecting at the moment?
I think a lot of the non-AI things are particularly interesting right now because everybody's working on the new shiny objects. And there's a bunch of businesses that are pouring that you could go in and add and basically totally fundamentally change their company by adding AI. So I've been looking at those industries, not really as an operator, but more as an investor. I haven't found anything in that space yet, but I think it's extraordinarily to kind of invest in any company that's pure AI right now, because I just don't know how they're going to be relevant in a year or two.
I think with the hype cycle, then the tide will go out. To quote Warren Buffett, you know, you see who's swimming without pants when the tide goes
right
out. And then, so it'll go like this, and then it'll, you know, have its like moment. I feel like crypto had its moment a few years ago.
Yeah.
Where it was all bubbly, and then NFTs and stuff that was like fundamentally like could be useful, but not in that format. But I feel like the rails are being built out, like those types of companies where I'm just like, remember crypto was all the rage? Now no one talks about it at all. But there's companies like Coinbase they're openly building out the rails to get everything certified. So you could do it above board. They could take institutional levels of money. Mm. Security is through the roof. All the rails are being built out. The process, everything's cheaper and easier to do. It used to cost like $50 to send $1 of Bitcoin. Now it costs 0.03 cents to send $1 billion of Bitcoin. So it's like companies like those are slowly starting to come back in my eyes that I'm seeing like, okay, they went through their hype phase. Now it's down to fundamentals and usefulness. And, you know, I could see something like Ethereum being a legit actual world-changing thing. Before, it was just a speculative currency.
Ethereum or Solana seem perfect for AI. Have you let an AI try to spend money for you?
No, I have personally not done it. I've watched people do it.
I've done it a ton.
Yeah.
And you can start to see the issues. Like I've given these agents my credit card. And one of the stupidest things that it did was it went out and bought the annual plan for something that it was testing, right? It'll do like things like that. Or it'll you know, buy the wrong thing. Nice thing with crypto, I feel like, is for the merchant, it's not reversible, which is great. Mm-hmm. And then two, most of these transactions are really small in nature. So you have a ton of credit card fees. Whereas with Ethereum or Solana, it's basically free in terms of the transaction
also,
fee.
Also, I think you could buy like electron cycles that it costs, right? Mm. So instead of like AWS did this with web hosting, I just pay $100 a month for web hosting, whether I hosted a web page or not.
Right.
And then it just went up from there. Instead, AWS is like, use 13 cents worth of AWS, just pay 13 cents. So I think the agents will be like, okay, I'm going to borrow this much whatever from you. I'll pay you 0.01 cent that it cost, and then I'll leave.
It makes so much more sense. Or paywalled articles, too. Like, you don't want a subscription to New York Times. You just want to read that one story. Let me pay a dollar or
something. I've been wishing for this for years, especially because I create content. I'm like, the value I create, I have to, like, go get sponsors to pay me for it.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the person consuming it that got value should just pay me, but it's too hard. And they don't want to pay me a dollar. But maybe they could say, tip the internet that I've read $5. And it sends, it breaks up. You spent 1/1,000,000,000th of your time on Neville's like one short reel. I'll give him 1/1,000,000,000 of a cent.
I love that idea.
But that was impossible with our current system. However, now with crypto, you can start doing those things. You can't send someone 1/1,000,000,000 of a cent.
That makes so much more sense to do it that way. Also with CAPTCHAs, you can get an AI now, an agent to solve any CAPTCHA, any CAPTCHA, which is a horrible system. It just means that people with better AIs are going to be able to not have to deal with CAPTCHAs. As humans, we have to put up with these really annoying things, which I barely pass now. It would make way more sense to use crypto, where you just pay an extremely small amount of money to access the website, and that's going to keep the bad actors out.
Yeah, and it says like your wallet has this much reputation, therefore you're good. And then if you get dinged, like there's a way to like do that. Yeah. So I, it's interesting looking at industries like that were like high and now that are kind of low, no one's paying attention, but will start to take over.
Crypto's coming back, I think.
Yeah, I think crypto in a new form of like a legit actual alternative to our USD currency or a layer on top of it. Like USDC, you can actually use in more ways than you can USD.
That's wild, isn't it? If you think about stablecoins, I heard that the US exports more dollars now through stablecoins than any other.
Well, stablecoins you could do a lot of stuff with.
Mm-hmm.
It's all digital. You could do a lot of cool stuff that you can't do with USD, which is a little confusing, but I'm excited about. So do you see any other industries like that you're paying attention to? Any specific industries?
One of the things that's been really fascinating is I created this AI of Scott Adams, who is the late Dilbert comic.
Uh-huh.
He was this guy who's tried to say apolitical, and I really enjoyed listening to his podcast. And he said, when I die, I want somebody to create an AI of mine to become immortal. And we put it out there. Millions of people have seen this guy, and people have asked us, like, oh, how can we support it? And I just feel wrong about having, you know, people pay anything. But it would be interesting if people watched it and they paid a really small amount of crypto or something that could go into the cost of doing each episode just from an AI, cost compute standpoint.
I've been watching these Richard Feynman videos.
Yeah,
and
I love
it. Like, I've seen every Richard Feynman video, and I'm starting to see new ones, and I'm like, it's clearly AI. Like, I mean, there's no way that this just came out. Like, it looks realistic, but there's no way this just came out. And sure enough, it's all AI. So it's like what he would have said about like what light actually is. Like, it's not like a particle. It's a whatever, you know, and they go into a whole explanation. You watch these videos and you're just like, this is a pretty damn cool use of AI.
I think as long as people know that it's not really Richard, what's the problem? I mean, that's wonderful.
I like it when they say it.
Yeah.
They're just like, this channel's called like AI Feynman. You're just like, thanks for not tricking me.
Right.
Don't trick me. Just tell me it's AI. I don't mind.
And if it's done right, it's able to access the whole corpus of information, everything Richard Feynman wrote, said, and explained it in his manner. That was what made him so great at it. I feel like he could explain the most complex subject so that anybody could understand it.
Yeah, he would compare atoms to just like jiggly balls. And the faster it jiggles, the hotter it is.
Right, right.
And you're like, oh yeah, that's pretty simple. I never heard it explained like that. But it's cool because it also does a video of him with all his inflections and movements and all that kind of stuff. It's amazing. So cool. Well, dude, thanks so much for being on here. How can people find you if they want to?
Probably the easiest way is just on X. I've recently got into that. I'm at John Arrow.
Yeah. Why have you started being a little bit more public now?
Yeah. So the catalyst was launching AI Scott Adams. People were trying to kind of dox me and say who was behind this thing. And so I decided I'm just going to own it and be proactive and tie it to myself. And I don't want to make it like seem like I'm doing this anonymously. If people have a problem with it, let me know. I want to talk about it.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I'm glad you're out there. There's a couple people that have like come out of the world, like Joe Lamont.
Yeah.
He was like so secretive. And now he's like out there with Alpha School. And I'm like, I'm glad that this guy is talking because he's been a cool guy and no one knows about him.
Well, and the other element of it is this is such an exciting phase. I mean, the world next year at this time is going to look COVID level different because of what's happening just with the agents specifically. And I want to find and have conversations like these because they're just so incredibly fascinating to me. So I'm really glad you had me on today. Thank you very much.
And you never know who reaches out of the woodworks. Like one out of a 1,000 something people that watch this, like maybe someone's like, oh yeah, I need to talk to that guy. It'd be a good matchup. So yeah,
for sure.
Cool, man. Thanks so much.
Hey,
appreciate
thank you,
it. This is fun. Hey, here's why you should check out swipefile.com. So great marketers don't guess. They just study what already works really well. So every top marketer back in the day kept a swipe file, collection of ads, emails, websites, marketing, high ROI campaigns. And these old swipe files were literally folders of ads. However, They're old, outdated. They're single format. They're not searchable. So nowadays, marketing comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Billboards, TV, radio, outdoor newspaper, posters, social media. I mean, everything, right? So we built Swipefile so you have a modern, organized, AI-powered Swipefile. It's for marketers, it's for founders, for people working in companies, people who own companies. You should really just check it out every once in a while. And here's a cool thing. We have hundreds of these high ROI campaigns collected, and it actually shows the cost it costs to make it, the revenue it generated, and the ROI. So you can copy some of these campaigns for your own business. Noah Kagan read one of our emails, said, "I love this email. I instantly thought of a marketing campaign and put our team on it." So from reading one free email, he got an idea and now his team is working on it. So every week we send you these new campaigns that spark ideas and you get access to our campaigns database. Pretty awesome deal, all for free. Go to swipefile.com, check it out.